Well, first, also my thanks to the organizers of this wonderful conference, and particularly to Felix for inviting me to this plenary session. My presentation will have a bit of a different focus. I'm not focusing so much on political economy, as Chris and Inza have done, but I focus more on the issue of culture, whereby I think that is not necessarily a contradiction, but I will come to that in my concluding points. With my presentation, I intend to contribute to a better understanding of the conservative others from a comparative transregional perspective. I did research, field research on neo-traditional authority in Southern Africa in the last few years, and I closely worked with numerous conservative, anti-liberal actors in its course. That is where the idea originated to compare my and others' findings from KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa, with selected empirical work on the rise of right-wing populist movements in the global north, and I will focus here on the United States. There's not enough time here to substantiate such a most different case approach. I just want to mention that the following comparison largely serves to apply insights from fieldwork in Southern Africa to recent political dynamics in the global north, and thus to outline what I see as some basic features of contemporary right-wing populism. What do I mean by the conservative others? In a forum on right-wing populism in the American Ethnologist from 2017, Hugh Gustafson contends that the conservative others have been little studied by anthropologists so far. By conservative others, he means the petty bourgeoisie, or the middle ground, as he calls it, which largely contributed to the rise of populist movements in the last two decades. Gustafson argues that they are strongly nationalist and resentful to those above them, the educated cosmopolitans, and below them, ethnic minorities and immigrants in particular. And if you want to understand populist persuasions, as I think it's also the intention of this plenary session here, this research gap is certainly a problem. And I think Chris also mentioned this point already. Mazzarella, who was briefly mentioned by Felix in the beginning and also by Inza, tries to explain why the topic of populism is awkward for anthropology and why there is a general trend to keep away from it. In his view, anthropology is in a way populist itself, because we usually ally ourselves with the common sense of common people, which becomes problematic, of course, when this common sense shows its dark side, as it currently does. My presentation is structured as follows. First, I elaborate on the concept of conservative impulse. Second, I explain what I mean by narratives of decline and discuss the significance of cultural belonging. Finally, I focus on another perspective or narrative, that of a rural-urban divide and the importance of local belonging and rural identity for the conservative others. Why do I speak of conservative actors and movements when the title of this plenary session is populist persuasions? What seems to be quite special about the term populist is that hardly any of those who are labeled as populist in public and academic debate use it as a self-description. A German political scientist, Philipp Mano, who did a book on the political economy of populism, criticizes that an apparent consensus currently exists in the social science literature, which understands populism as a specific form of political debate or as a political style. So fake news, hate speech, we all know that. In other words, many researchers argue that populism has no specific political content, although some maintain that anti-elitism and anti-pluralism are the lowest common denominator. I'm not convinced by the argument that populism is merely a political style, and I contend that underlying right-wing populist movements, and I'm not dealing with the extreme far-right and left-wing populism here, so underlying this right-wing populism is what has been referred to as a conservative impulse by sociologists Peter Maris and more recently Peter Waldman. Maris originally developed this concept when he interviewed widows who had lost their husbands and were forced to cope with this radical and irreversible change. He He then compared it with other instances of loss and change, which is also the title of his book from 1974. For example, the rise of ethno-nationalism and ethnic conflict in urban settings in post-colonial Nigeria. Maris argues that both, quote, both arise from situations where the meaningfulness of life is threatened by the loss of familiar relationships, unquote, and that both express the same inherent conflict, neither to bury the past nor be buried in it. What Mary sees at work in such situations of drastic social change, or to be more precise, in the initial stages, is a conservative impulse. For Waldman, the conservative impulse is a partly intuitive, partly conscious reaction to social change. It refers to attitudes and practices that are rooted in what he calls traditional patterns, and it is inspired by the desire to preserve what is there or to restore what has just been lost. That is, both Waldman and Maris do not deal with, and me myself here also, with conservatism as a political ideology, which is also as difficult to grasp conceptually as populism, probably. But they, and I'm referring to conservative attitudes and practices. In the following, I focus on two aspects of the conservative impulse that I consider as significant, that are narratives of decline and the perception of a rural-urban divide. I contend that narratives of decline are another expression of the conservative impulse and thus bear similarities to the widow's reactions interviewed by Maris on bereavement, as well as the rise of ethno-nationalism in post-colonial settings. My understanding of narratives of decline is not unlike to what has been named cultural anxiety by Grillo and others, that is an, quote, anxiety about a culture and what is happening to it, unquote. Cultural anxiety refers to threat and fear, but the notion of narratives of decline goes a bit further. It is not just about a subjectively felt threat to what is perceived as one owns culture, but far-reaching social change is equated with loss and collapse. And the crucial point seems to me that this supposed decline is generally perceived in cultural categories and less in socio-economic terms. Let me give an example. In his book, Democracy as Death, The Moral Order of Anti-Liberal Politics in South Africa, Jason Hickel investigates the political ideas of Zulu migrant workers who migrate from rural areas of KwaZulu-Natal to the cities where they stay for most time of the year. One of the workers, and Hickel argues this is a widespread view amongst them, substantiates his disapproval of liberal democracy in the following way. I quote, "The culture of the rural areas is based on Hlonipa, but these days Hlonipa is going down. This is why everything is falling apart in South Africa. It is because of democracy and the Bill of Rights." Hlonipa refers to a system of avoidance and taboo that regulates respectful behavior across social hierarchies, so meaning age and gender. If we look at statements by Tea Party supporters in the US, we find comparable narratives, and the decline is primarily perceived in cultural categories as well. And similar to KwaZulu-Natal, where the migrant workers blame the liberal social policy of the government for the decline, and not the neoliberal economic policy, the societal divide in the US is understood as a cultural struggle rather than a class conflict by the conservative others. Westermeyer, who conducted field research with local Tea Party activists in North Carolina, mentions what he calls a deep-seated cultural anxiety and a widespread feeling that the nation is in a process of irreversible decline. The activists complain about supposed erosion of so-called American values and that political ideals such as local autonomy and small government are trampled on, in their words. What makes things even worse from the perspective of Tea Party supporters is that state representatives and the political elite in Washington do not prevent the perceived cultural erosion. Even worse, they actively push ahead the decline. That is at least what Ali Hochschild argues in a book on Tea Party supporters in Louisiana. I quote again, "The federal government stood up for the biological environment, but it was allowing, and it seemed at times, it was causing a cultural erosion. What seemed to my Tea Party friends to be dangerously polluted, unclean, and harmful was American culture." Unquote. Hochschild frequently refers to perceived threats that are expressed by her interlocutors, who feel like strangers in their own land, which is also the main title of her book. These threats concern, amongst others, the erosion of community spirit and of local autonomy. Last but not least, the supposed cultural decline in both cases concerns the highly conflictual question of immigration. In KwaZulu-Natal, there were several phases of xenophobic riots in the last 15 years, and in some cases, conservative elites have contributed to the violence. For example, a controversial speech by Zulu King Goodwill Zwelithini in 2015 kicked off, or at least pushed, the subsequent xenophobic riots in Durban. The conflict about immigration is certainly in the center of the rise of right-wing populism in the US. Interestingly, and also a bit confusingly maybe, and this is often mentioned by researchers directly interacting with the conservative others, explicit racist comments about immigrants and ethnic minorities rather seem to be an exception. However, cultural anxiety is associated with immigration, and immigrants are perceived as a key symbol for cultural decline. I come to my second point, aspect, that is characteristic from my point of view for right-wing populism, the notion of a rural urban divide. And Chris also mentioned that with respect to Hungary. In KwaZulu-Natal, the African National Congress turned to a neo-traditionalist and ethnic political agenda during the presidency of Jacob Zuma. In addition, the party and its leadership reached out to rural areas under the control of chiefs in order to seize a rural constituency. For the Zulu migrant workers investigated by Hickel, rural and local forms of belonging are crucial and have a double meaning. First, in the sense of what one owns, that is land, and second, in terms of membership and resulting political rights in a locally and culturally defined community. In other words, cultural as well as local belonging are crucial and somehow reinforce each other. With reference to Mahmoud Mandani's book, Citizen and Subject, Hickel argues that a bifurcation of moral orders exists between conservative rural versus liberal urban South Africans, and that this rural-urban divide was a key component of collective violence in KwaZulu-Natal in the 1980s and 1990s, in which about 20,000 people died. Hickel also exemplifies the importance of the rural origins and of the patriarchal hierarchical rural home for the Zulu migrant workers. Although, or maybe because, they stay in urban areas for most time of the year, they disapprove of the prevailing liberal values and political ideas and perceive them as foreign and hostile. With regard to the US, the rural-urban divide is often interpreted as a difference between rural Republicans and urban Democrats. In her book, The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin and the Rise of Scott Walker, Catherine Kramer criticizes this simplifying perspective and argues that rural areas in Wisconsin are characterized by a rural consciousness, as she calls it, which exceeds and is more fundamental than the political divide between Democrats and Republicans. According to Kramer, belonging to rural areas functions as a lens through which rural Wisconsinites interpret political events. Rural consciousness means an identity as a rural person that includes much more than an attachment to place. It includes a sense that decision makers routinely ignore rural places and fail to give rural communities their fair share of resources, as well as a sense that rural folks are fundamentally different from urbanites in terms of lifestyles, values, and work ethic. In other words, the rural consciousness contains three dimensions that are who exercises power and how. How and how just or unjust are state resources divided between rural and urban citizens? And third, what are the relevant values and lifestyle from a rural perspective? Let me add a few remarks on the latter dimension, the question of values. Kramer argues that a specific work ethic, to work with one's own hands, that is, craftsmanship in a very narrow sense, has great relevance for many rural Wisconsinites. From their perspective, this work distinguishes them from urbanites who allegedly sit behind an office desk day in and day out. It is connected with a pronounced skepticism towards state bureaucracy. According to Kramer, rural Wisconsinites attach much significance to personal face-to-face interactions in sharp contrast to routine bureaucratic procedures. One quote in Kramer's book struck me in particular, and it highlights the anti-elitist and, I think, also anti-academic impulse in right-wing populism. Kramer's interlocutor distinguishes between what he calls real and apparent work and criticizes state employees in government offices and at universities with the words, quote, "They shower before work, not afterwards." I mean, if we would still have the green and red cards from the Mitgliederversammlung yesterday, we could do now an empirical test whether that has some relevance or not. But to be serious, I mean, that is an aspect, this issue of work ethic, that also appeared in interviews that I just started with members of the Werteunion and the Christian Democratic Union. So what is quite interesting, a basic democratic, as they call themselves, basic democratic movement within the German Conservative Party, and in interviews with members of the Werteunion, also the question of work ethic often. I can just make an anecdote, but I must do that in German, and I found that quite, I mean, this has a humoristic element, yeah, but on the other hand, it's also quite shocking. And I think that is also one aspect, I didn't go into that here, but this common sense and humoristic element in populist movements, I think that is also an issue that is quite interesting that we should maybe focus on. But she said, I mean, she's heavily criticizing what she calls the elite, the political elite within her party, yeah. And she said that most of those in higher positions in the CDU directly went from the Kreissaal to the Hörsaal to the Plenarsaal, yeah. Meaning that they didn't really work in their entire life so far. Okay, to conclude, I would like to emphasize two points in brief. First, and to link up with Chris and Ina's work, I want to make clear that I also think that political economy is important for understanding the rise of right-wing populist movements. There is no principal contradiction between our analysis from my point of view, but I put the emphasis on the question why social change and economic decline are often perceived in terms of cultural erosion and interpreted as cultural struggle. Second, I hope it became clear that I'm not interested in another form of othering, and that the term conservative others is a very provisional and also provocative vehicle in a research project of mine that is just about to start. In contrast, I think it is crucial, and also maybe even specifically for anthropology, that point was also raised here, to do research on and interact with those we particularly dislike, and whose political views are often in sharp contrast to ours. Or to rephrase the conference theme a bit, I think the negotiations have to start, not to end. The sooner, the better. Thank you very much for your attention.